French settlement, a local Indian tribe had destroyed it. Spain reclaimed the area and through a series of negotiations with France reclaimed East Texas from France. It was previously considered part of the Louisiana Territory. Spain retained control of this area known as New Spain until Mexico's War of Independence, which ended in 1821. Mexico encouraged immigration to their new country, which included Texas, as a means to defend against the Comanche Nation. Many Americans settled in the area, and many of them were slave owners. The Mexican president, Anastasio Bustamante, ordered that slavery be outlawed and all slaves be freed by 1830. To try and get around this type of law, slave owners declared their slaves indentured servants for life, thus continuing the system just under a different name. It was estimated that by 1836 there were 5,000 slaves living in Texas. Bustamante also declared a ban on U.S. immigration, which is ironic considering the modern-day U.S. immigration policies. There were other changes to Mexican government that were pushing Texans towards rebellion and independence, primarily the fact that Mexico's government was becoming more and more centralized, giving Texas less independence to govern itself. During this time, the United States twice offered to purchase Texas from Mexico for the price of $1 million. Both times, the sale was rejected. Bustamante made many legal changes that were aimed at Texas, including threatening military action to enforce the ban on slavery, raises on taxes and tariffs, and the ban on immigration. In 1834, the next president of Mexico, Santa Anna, rescinded the Mexico Constitution of 1824, thus creating the right environment for a civil war. Originally, Stephen F. Austin, considered the father of Texas, stated that they simply wanted to exist as an independent state of Mexico. However, after several months, he changed his tune and declared that Texas should be an independent republic and called for war against Mexico. In October of 1835, the Battle of Gonzales officially kicked off the Texas Revolution, while Santa Anna abolished all state legislatures. Battles waged on, and on March 2, 1836, Texas signed its own Declaration of Independence and created the Republic of Texas. However, just because the documents were signed did not mean the fighting was over. Shortly after signing the Declaration of Independence, the most famous battle in Texas history took place, the Battle of the Alamo. The Alamo was formerly a Spanish mission outpost that had been converted into a slapdash fort. It was capable of defending against native tribes, but would never be able to handle heavy artillery. The Alamo is located close to present-day San Antonio. There was an argument that the location was strategically important, so Colonel James Bowie requested additional forces, but received few reinforcements in return. Among some of the volunteers to arrive, however, were William Barrett Travis and David Crockett. A struggling Mexican army was slowly approaching the Bexar, San Antonio area, and a 13-day siege on the Alamo began on February 23rd. Santa Anna gave the fort one final chance to surrender, but instead, Commander Travis opted to fire on the Mexican forces, thus starting the battle. The forces at the Alamo were small, with approximately 200 defenders, and there were several skirmishes over the following days, while the Texian, citizens of Texas, forces hoped for reinforcements. According to legend, Travis assembled his men, explained that the situation was dire, and drew a line in the sand. Those willing to fight would stand with him, and those that chose to leave would stand on the other side. This makes for a dramatic story, but unfortunately there is no clear evidence to support this. However, it's believed that Travis did give anyone unwilling to fight a chance to escape. In the early morning hours of March 6, 2,000 Mexican forces began their surreptitious approach to the fort and quickly killed the sentinels before they had a chance to alert the others. Most were still asleep. The Texian forces fought valiantly, but they were outnumbered 10-1. There was no way they would win the battle. All of the defenders were killed, with Santa Anna taking a particularly cruel approach, bayoneting bodies to ensure their deaths and burning the bodies. This battle inspired passion among Texians and encouraged recruitment to the army. In April, the Texians took their revenge at the Battle of San Jacinto, taking Santa Anna hostage until a peace treaty was signed, thus ending the revolution. Despite the fact that the war was over, Mexico refused to recognize Texas's independence, and conflicts occurred through the 1840s. The United States recognized Texas as an independent republic. The Texas Constitution legalized slavery, but banned the foreign slave trade. Immigrants who owned slaves could bring them to Texas, and no free blacks were admitted to the country without authorization from Congress. The Republic of Texas operated as a sovereign country until its annexation by the United States in 1846, at which point the U.S. inherited Texas's border disputes with Mexico, instigating the Mexican-American War. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, to the people of Texas and all Americans in the world, fellow citizens and compatriots, I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Anna, and I have sustained a continual bombardment and cannonade for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion, otherwise the garrison are to be put to the sword if the fort is taken. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character, to come to our aid. With all dispatch, the enemy is receiving reinforcements daily, and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. If this call is neglected, I am determined to sustain myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his own honor and that of his country. Victory or death. William Barrett Travis, Lieutenant Colonel Commandant. Texas Annexation and Mexican and Spanish Cessions. The United States was at this point far larger than any of its European counterparts except Russia. The nation was not done growing yet. Spain still held territory in Florida, but their strength in the Americas was weakening, and the Spanish were not interested in investing further into the colony. This led to the cession of Florida from Spain again in a diplomatic way instead of by war. Military conflict was not entirely absent, however, as tribes and escaped slaves had been raiding Georgia, originally created as a buffer to the lucrative Carolinas. And American troops had made incursions into the Spanish territory. Spain was unable to control the area, and hence it was more susceptible to relinquishing control of the land. A few American politicians demanded Spain give up Texas too, but that would have to wait 26 years. The cession of Florida was not a purchase, like Louisiana, but the United States agreed to pay legal claims from American citizens against Spain up to $5 million and gave Spanish goods preferential tariff treatment at Floridian ports. Under the treaty, named the Adams-Onis Treaty, Spain was granted secure control over Texas west to California. The area had originally been a point of dispute between Spain and the United States, as the United States claimed the Louisiana Purchase had granted control to the Rocky Mountains. Under manifest destiny and the march towards the 42nd parallel of latitude, the United States lost some territory to Britain in the area north of modern Montana. This now lies within Canada, which at the time of the cession was still part of Britain. Shortly before the American Civil War, Texas was annexed by the United States. The state was a large slave-holding independent republic which had declared itself separate from Mexico in 1836. The political climate of the United States at the time was tumultuous, with a divide between the industrial North and agricultural South already having been developed. The addition of Texas would significantly add to the southern side of power, and northern politicians opposed it nonetheless. Texas became part of the American territory in 1845, much to the celebration of most Texans, who favored entry into the Union. The Texans were largely Americans who had moved into Mexican territory on the invitation of the Mexican government and who wanted to populate the area. The annexation of Texas was the major contributing factor to the Mexican-American War, which lasted from 1846 to 1848. This war holds the interesting distinction of being the first war the U.S. fought on foreign soil. The war was costly for Mexico, who was largely unprepared for continued fighting. Operating under the philosophy of manifest destiny, the United States felt it should expand its territory while the still new Mexican government fought to protect its lands. Ultimately, Mexico lost about one-third of its territory. The U.S. gained most of present-day California, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, and New Mexico. Not long after the Texas annexation, Britain ceded the Oregon territories to the United States in 1846 in another manifest destiny treaty. 2 years later, Mexico gave up its claim to the American Southwest after a very long and bloody war. This mostly rounded out the current shape of the lower 48. The area along the Rio Grande, still part of Mexican territory, was purchased by the United States in 1853 in order to complete a transcontinental railway. The last two additions, Hawaii and Alaska, would have to wait until after the American Civil War. One of the primary reasons for this massive expansion and its invariable success was the American sense of new freedom and independence. Suddenly, the entire country was theirs, and with so much of the territory owned or operated by foreign powers, the obvious conclusion was that it would be easier to simply purchase it themselves. It was often a costly process to run colonies, and unless they were centrally located and able to supply a very high in-demand product, such as tea in India, the risk-loss ratios were rarely worth it, especially now in the pre-industrial era when new technologies were being developed. For many foreign colonial powers, it might have come as an actual relief to not have to worry about these distant outposts. Also contributing to this massive expansion was the fact that America had proved its worth in the American Revolution against what was then one of the most powerful global powers, Britain. Many of the outlying colonial powers, like France, were already engaged in other battles and wars elsewhere, and the idea of going to war with the patriotic willpower of the Americans was not attractive. Lastly, for the colonists themselves, a sense of manifest destiny had given them a newfound sense of purpose. Numerous towns spread west, and in the more remote areas where it was difficult to maintain supply lines, it had suddenly become necessary to invest in their new country. California Gold Rush. While many settlers were uninterested in trying to settle out west, all that changed once gold nuggets were discovered at the beginning of 1848 in the Sacramento Valley. It all started when a carpenter named James Wilson Marshall found a few gold flakes in the American River near what is now Coloma, California. As soon as the news started spreading about people finding gold out west, thousands of people flocked by both land and sea to the San Francisco area. People were auctioning off their homes and spending their life savings just to have the opportunity to travel out west and make a fortune. Because of the large number of people that made their way to the California coast during 1849, the nickname 49ers came into being. By the end of 1849, the population of California had increased from 1,000 Americans to around 100,000 American inhabitants. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. San Francisco, California, October 18, 1849. My dear and faraway wife, Janie, I will briefly describe the look of things around me. I am sitting in the tent, a box covered with a cloth is our eating table on which I write. At the back end is piled our beds. On either side is hardware of all descriptions, from steam cylinder to a paper of tacks. Outside are casks of codfish meal, etc. Our fireplace is close by with a small stove. Just beyond is beach. A little to the right, they are building a steamboat, and all around is the sound of hammer on boathouse or iron. Clothing of all descriptions strews the ground all over, left by those who have camped here and gone to the mines. Shirts never worn but once or twice are thrown away rather than pay for washing. 50 cents is the charge for washing a piece, or $6 per dozen and no less. So collars and bosoms, etc., are thrown away indiscriminately. I have seen pants whole and sound and but little soiled thrown away. Excerpt from a letter from Hiram Dwight Pierce to Sarah Jane Pierce. The California Gold Rush reached its peak in 1852, pulling about 81 million worth of gold from the ground. From there, the total slowly declined. The discovery of gold in the California region was without question a major factor in the area joining the Union as a state. Slavery in the 1800s. The mechanics of slavery began to change in the early 1800s. Many states were beginning to ban foreign slave trading, and in 1800, Congress passed a law forbidding U.S. citizens from exporting slaves. In the early 1800s, while some states, such as South Carolina, were ramping up their efforts to import more slaves, other states, such as Pennsylvania and New Jersey, were taking legal measures to gradually emancipate slaves. Conflicting laws were popping up between federal regulations and state regulations, building towards what would become the bloodiest conflict in American history, the Civil War. In 1819, Missouri requested admittance into the Union as a slave state, which would upset the current balance of slave states and free states. Accepting Missouri as a slave state would have the implication that the U.S. approved the expansion of slavery. So, as a way to defuse a simmering conflict, the Missouri Compromise was born. Missouri would join the Union as a slave state, while Maine joined simultaneously as a free state, thus maintaining the careful balance. The act also stated that in the future, any Louisiana-purchased lands north of the 36th parallel would be free states, which was ultimately repealed by the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. During the first half of the 1800s, the Underground Railroad started to successfully move runaway slaves through secret routes and safe houses to escape to free states in the North and Canada. Some routes took former slaves to Mexico or overseas. The concept of a secret system to help escaped slaves reach freedom had existed since George Washington's time, but the term Underground Railroad was officially coined in 1831. Many of the conductors of the railroad were free blacks, such as former slave Harriet Tubman, church leaders, northern abolitionists, and philanthropists. Harriet Tubman was cited as making as many as 19 return trips to the South to help slaves escape. Another well-known conductor was Levi Coffin, a Quaker abolitionist and humanitarian. It's estimated he aided approximately 3,000 people to freedom. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1793 required that officials from free states assist slave owners in tracking down and returning escaped slaves, but this act was poorly regulated and thus largely ignored. Routes along the Underground Railroad were intentionally convoluted, and escapees traveled by wagon, train, boat, or foot. William Still, sometimes known as the father of the Underground Railroad, kept careful records of the lives of the escaped slaves who he helped and eventually published his observations in his book, The Underground Railroad, Authentic Narratives and First-Hand Accounts, published in 1872. This helped many understand the plight of runaway slaves prior to emancipation. Many slaves hoped to reach the Promised Land or Canada, and historians debate the actual numbers, with estimates of the number of escaped slaves who made it to Canada ranging from 30,000 to 100,000 people. While some states made laws and regulations towards abolishing slavery or granting more rights to freed blacks, other states made increasingly prohibitive laws that denied slaves even the right to learn to read or write. In North Carolina, an 1831 law said that you couldn't even give a slave a piece of written material. Nat Turner's rebellion occurred that same year and was the most successful slave uprising on American soil. Nat Turner was educated in reading, writing, and religion, and believed he was divinely chosen to avenge slavery and lead fellow slaves from bondage. Turner's rebellion was violent. The slaves in revolt killed as many as 60 people, and the uprising lasted 2 days. Many slaves were executed for their participation, and many slaves were punished, even though they did not participate. It was at this point that many states began to restrict education for slaves. The 1800s was a time of political movement in terms of slavery as states began to make their final stance for or against slavery in the period leading up to the Civil War. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, June 22, 55, arrived William Nelson and Susan, his wife, and his son, William Thomas, also Louisiana Bell and Elias Jasper, all arrived from Norfolk per Captain B. William is about 40. Dark chestnut, medium-sized, very intelligent, member of the Methodist Church under the charge of the Reverend Mr. Jones. His owner's name was Turner and Whitehead, with whom he had served for 20 years in the capacity of packer. He had been treated with mildness in some respects, though had been very tightly worked, allowed only $1.50 per week to board and clothe himself and family upon. Consequently, he was obliged to make up the balance as he could. Had been sold once one sister had been sold also, he was prompted to escape because he wanted his liberty, was not satisfied with not having the privilege of providing for his family. His value, $1,000. Paid $240 for himself, wife, and child, and Miss Bell. Susan is about 30, dark, rather above medium size, well-made, good-looking, intelligent, and a member of the same church to which her husband belonged, was owned by Thomas Bottomore, with whom she had lived for 7 years. Her treatment a part of the time had been mild. The marriage of her master, however, made a change. Afterwards, she had been treated badly. Her master, to gratify his wife, constantly threatening to sell her. four of her sisters had been sold away to parts unknown years ago, left father and mother, three brothers and one sister. Still in Virginia, living about 100 miles from Norfolk, 1,000 was the demand of the owner for Susan and her child, 22 months old. From William Still's book, The Underground Railroad, a record of facts, authentic narratives, letters, and etc., narrating the hardships, hairbreadth escape, and death struggles of slaves in their efforts for freedom, as related by themselves and others, or witnessed by the author. Misconceptions. There were no survivors at the Alamo. Not true. There were no adult Anglo-Texan male survivors at the Alamo, but several Tejano women and children survived, as well as Susanna Dickinson and her daughter, well-known eyewitnesses of the Battle of the Alamo. In total, an estimated 17 people not involved in direct combat survived the battle. California was not the first gold rush. The discovery of gold in California was not the first major gold rush. The United States saw its first gold rush in North Carolina after gold was discovered on the Reed family farm in 1799. Gold was also found in 1829 in the mountains of Georgia, starting the second gold rush. Discovery of gold in the area sparked the interest of the U.S. government, leading to the displacement of Cherokee peoples. Can you believe this happened? How did Lewis and Clark meet? A. A friend introduced them. B. They met at church. C. They met through the army. D. They met at a tavern. Lewis and Clark met after Lewis was transferred to a different rifle company. The interesting part is that Lewis had to transfer after he was court-martialed for supposedly challenging another officer to a duel. Although he was found guilty, his superior officers thought it best to transfer him, leading to the two future explorers meeting. What nickname was associated with the 1849 gold miners? A. Panners. B. Sourdough. C. Goldies. Or D. Rushers. The California Gold Rush brought with it new cultures, foods, and people. The French bakers brought sourdough bread to the West Coast, and gold miners were sometimes given the name sourdough. You can still see evidence of this term today. The San Francisco 49ers American football team mascot is named Sourdough Sam. History has its eyes on us today. The California Gold Rush saw an influx of travelers both domestically and internationally. During the Gold Rush, many Chinese people immigrated to the United States and were often hired for massive labor projects, such as the Transcontinental Railroad. Due to the public perception of the Chinese at the time, most immigrants became restricted to jobs in restaurants and laundry work. In 1882, President Chester A. Arthur signed the Chinese Exclusion Act into law, disallowing Chinese immigration. This was after a series of acts that gradually restricted immigration. The Chinese Exclusion Act was the first law prohibiting a specific ethnic group from immigrating to the U.S. The law was not repealed until 1943. In today's climate of extremism, there are some who believe in restricting immigration once more. Indian Removal Act. In 1830, then-President Andrew Jackson signed into law the Indian Removal Act of 1830. This law permitted the evacuation and relocation, often forcefully, of Native American people from their native lands into a single large settlement in Oklahoma. There were two reasons why Jackson signed this infamous bill. One reason was so that the government could sell the lands formerly owned by Native Americans to the settlers, mainly because there were reports of gold in the area. The other reason was the recommendation of the former president, James Monroe. In his last speech to Congress, Monroe emphasized the need to relocate the Native American people because he felt they were stopping the migration of settlers westward. It seems like Jackson believed the same thing. Upon its passing, the Indian Removal Act effectively displaced almost 125,000 Native Americans, mostly from the Cherokee Nation, from their ancestral homes in Georgia, and sent the people, both young and old, trekking thousands of miles on foot towards their new settlement in Oklahoma. An estimated 4,000 Native Americans died either through exhaustion, hunger, or exposure while on the way to Oklahoma. This huge number of casualties is what led this forced exodus to get the moniker, the Trail of Tears. What effect did the Trail of Tears have on the Native American people? Besides the forced relocation, the Native Americans were also forced to adapt to the dynamics of a new economic system that was completely alien to their original beliefs. For instance, Native Americans had to come to terms with the notion that land could be bought and sold, and no longer something that one must hold on to and protect for future generations of his family. The conceptual ideas and whole cosmogony of the natives differed from the manifest destiny philosophy of the newly independent United States. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, the removal of Cherokee Indians from their lifelong homes in the year of 1838 found me, a young man in the prime of life and a private soldier in the American Army. Being acquainted with many of the Indians and able to fluently speak their language, I was sent as an interpreter into the Smoky Mountain country in May 1838 and witnessed the execution of the most brutal order in the history of American warfare. I saw helpless Cherokees arrested and dragged from their homes and driven at the bayonet point into the stockades. And in the chill of a drizzling rain on an October morning, I saw them loaded like cattle or sheep into 645 wagons and started towards the west. One can never forget the sadness and solemnity of that morning. Chief John Ross led in prayer, and when the bugle sounded and the wagons started rolling, many of the children rose to their feet and waved their little hands goodbye to their mountain homes, knowing they were leaving them forever. Many of these helpless people did not have blankets, and many of them had been driven from their home barefooted. Birthday story of Private John G. Burnett, Captain Abraham McClellan's Company, 2nd Regiment, 2nd Brigade, Mounted Infantry, Cherokee Indian Removal, 1838-39. For many Native Americans, the land was not something to own, but rather something to be respected, and they thought of their relationship to it as symbiotic. By displacing a people, the government was actually destroying their culture, something so valuable that once it was lost or destroyed, it was very difficult to get it back. Were there tribes that opposed the Indian Removal Act? Of course. Numerous Native Americans were averse to the new law that forced them to leave their homes. The Cherokee tribe was one of those most strongly opposed, and they tried to fight the Indian Removal Act. They filed a case against the entire state of Georgia, which eventually found its way to the Supreme Court, where Justice John Marshall declared that the government had no right to claim the Cherokees' ancestral lands as its own. Unfortunately, President Jackson overruled this declaration and allowed it to push through. A number of other nations also rose up, including the Seminole people who had lived in the Florida area. A militia of 500 men was organized to deal with the Indian problem, but the Seminoles were a hardy and fierce people, and their guerrilla tactics worked initially. They would capture supply lines and burn plantations, which actually helped to boost their numbers, as freed slaves would then join their cause. The decade of fighting would be a bloody and gruesome affair for both sides, with the United States government and the Army dedicating nearly $20 million to the fight. This number was almost unheard of, and in today's market would be the equivalent to nearly $491 million. While the Seminole Indian bands did suffer great casualty, they represent a victory in the native history of the United States, since the government and Army eventually gave up fighting them. To this day, they still proudly consider themselves the only Native people in North America to have never relinquished. Their sovereignty or signed a peace treaty. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, December 3rd, went forward, crossed the Oklawa at the lower end of a lake on the temporary bridge constructed by General Eustace. Soon after, captured an Indian from whom information was obtained of the situation of a Negro village at the head of the lake. Detached Lieutenant Colonel Caulfield with two companies of his battalion, accompanied by Captain Crossman and Lieutenant Chambers. Also by an interpreter and the Indian prisoner, General Jay, moved forward with the remainder of the command about 5 miles and camped on a beautiful lake. Lieutenant Colonel Caulfield returned about 9 p.m. with 41 Negro prisoners, having surprised the village, captured the greater part of its inhabitants, and burnt the houses and property which they could not bring in. Diary of Thomas Sidney Jessup, Commander in the Second Seminole War. One of the major problems with these treaties was, first, the leaders of the tribes often did not speak for all of their members, and second, many of the chiefs were manipulated or coerced into signing treaties that may or may not have represented their best interests. There are also countless instances in American history involving certain conditionals. For example, a number of nations in what is now Oregon were given a choice between signing a treaty that said they gave up their ancestral lands and had to move, or going to war with the local military station there. Additionally, many treaties were found to be signed by chiefs who only later realized that the magistrates in control had forged their signatures entirely. The original treaties that took place on the East Coast would set a precedent for nearly 200 years involving the slow and gradual attrition of native land. The Trail of Tears is the worst case of human rights violation to happen to the Native American population. Not only were they forced to leave the lands they used to call their homes, but they were given little to no compensation in exchange for their relocation. Misconceptions. The Indian Removal Act did not have overwhelming support. While the act was supported heavily by the southern states, who would benefit the most from the new land acquisition, it only passed the House with a vote of 101-97. Many Christian missionaries also opposed the act. If the choice were yours, in the interest of acquiring resources for the country, how would you communicate with local residents? Would you try to make trade agreements or take physical action? In reality, President Andrew Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act into law in 1830. Plans for forcible removal began in the early 1800s, and the discovery of gold in the Cherokee lands of North Georgia sped up the legislation process. The Indian Removal Act impacted the lives of the Cherokee, Choctaw, Muscogee Creek, Seminole, Chickasaw, Wyandot, Kickapoo, Lenape, Shawnee, and Potawatomi nations and tribes. Some of the tribes adopted customs and traditions of Anglo-Americans, but were still forced from their lands. History has its eyes on us today. The forceful removal of Native Americans from their home territories as a result of the Indian Removal Act was just one of many elements of a long-standing tumultuous relationship between the United States government and indigenous tribes. Even today, though Native nations operate independently, the government is in conflict with them over land usage and land rights.
Chapter 4, The Civil War, Reconstruction, and the Gilded Age. Abraham Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the American Civil War. According to the Declaration of Independence, all men are created with an equal right to liberty. However, President Abraham Lincoln had his doubts as to whether the people really understood what that part of the Declaration meant, because, as of that time, the United States was the largest country in the world where it was still legal to own slaves, although in the North it had been banned since 1803. The political landscape at the time was a tumultuous one because there was a great division about how to approach slavery, with the South very much in favor of it. In his famous Peoria speech, delivered on October 16, 1854, Lincoln, who had previously disagreed with his nemesis Stephen A. Douglas on letting each state legislate its own laws about slavery, as opposed to having Congress dictate the matter, finally spoke out and made his stance clear. This would come back later in his famous Douglas-Lincoln debates in 1858, in which Lincoln attempted to decry the act of slavery as being something that undermined the principles not only of republicanism, but of the Founding Fathers' real message that all men are created equal. Causes of the War. Although slavery was the major factor that drove the Civil War, other events occurred that helped move it along. For starters, there was a tariff or tax that had been suggested in the 1820s by President Andrew Jackson, which caused a wedge between the North and the South. The Tariff of 1828, also known as the Tariff of Abominations, was meant to protect the Northern market from cheap foreign goods. The Tariff of Abomination not only drove away the foreign market, but it also increased the cost of living for Southern states. Another tariff replaced this in 1832, but with the same high rates and effects on the Southern economy. The tariff benefited the North significantly, but harmed the South. There's no question that this created division in the United States. South Carolina, who had leaders that were major advocates for states' rights, nullified these tariffs. The idea of nullification, or the refusal of a state to obey a federal law, if it determined that the law was not in the best interest of the state, was a big deal in the Revolution and proved so again in the Civil War. Returning to the subject of slavery, many events contributed to the actual war taking place. The end of the Mexican-American War brought about some important questions. Because there were mixed feelings about slavery, there was a question as to whether or not these new territories would be considered slave states or free states. The Compromise of 1850 solved the problem by making California free and allowing the other states to use popular sovereignty to determine their status. The Fugitive Slave Act, which was a component of the Compromise of 1850, essentially held Northerners responsible for bringing slaves who had escaped to go north back to the South. Although the act had good intentions, it drove a further wedge between the two sides. Southerners felt like they were getting the short end of the stick, and Northerners felt like they were being forced to comply with something they did not believe in. Other events, like the release of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Bleeding Kansas, and the Dred Scott decision, also caused abolitionists to increase their efforts to get rid of slavery. Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was written by Harriet Beecher Stowe, told the story of slavery through the eyes of a slave. The evil depiction of slavery that the book portrayed caused an uproar on both sides. Northerners were horrified by the cruelty that slaves were experiencing, while Southerners saw it as an unfair and exaggerated portrayal of what really occurred. Bleeding Kansas goes back to the Kansas-Nebraska Act that stated that the territory could decide for itself whether or not it wanted to be a slave state or a free state. Both the Northern abolitionists and Southerners were appalled. A race began with each side sending people to the territory to try to tip the scale in their favor. As murders and massacres started occurring, the term Bleeding Kansas came to describe the rush for power in the territory. Even in the supposedly diplomatic spectrum, violence erupted between a senator named Andrew Butler, a senator named Charles Sumner, and a congressman named Preston Brooks. Sumner was an abolitionist and spouted off a 3-hour rant that was firmly against the Kansas-Nebraska Act. Brooks was upset about the rude comments made by Sumner towards his uncle, who was also a senator, during the rant. A couple of days later, he nearly caned Sumner to death. This exacerbated the negative feelings already present between both sides. The Dred Scott decision was yet another event that shook the nation and further drew both sides apart. In 1847, Dred Scott sued for his freedom. Essentially, Scott had been free at one time, and then he and his wife went to his master, who had moved back to a slave state. After his master died, Scott tried to buy both his and his wife's freedom, since he had been free already. Upon refusal of his attempts to buy his freedom from his master's widow, he then went through the courts to try to establish his freedom. Eventually, the case made it all the way up to the United States Supreme Court in 1857. The justices ended up ruling that because Dred Scott had African ancestry, he could never be a citizen. Therefore, he did not have the ability to sue. On top of that, the decision also said that the Missouri Compromise, which was almost 30 years old, was unconstitutional and Congress did not have the authority to prohibit slavery in a territory. The final major event that occurred before the Civil War came into full effect was the raid on Harper's Ferry, which is in the Virginia area. In 1859, an abolitionist named John Brown wanted to incite a slave uprising. He and his men were trying to gather supplies so that they could both establish a group of freed slaves in the mountainsides of both Maryland and Virginia. Unfortunately, word traveled about the raid and they were captured a couple of days later. Brown and his men were executed. Although the South viewed John Brown's actions as an act of treason, the North saw Brown as a martyr for the cause and described him as such. Essentially, the South felt like the North was seeking to destroy their way of life and they were not going to go quietly. Election of 1860. Although a somewhat awkward-looking president, he was extremely tall to the average person. Lincoln quickly proved himself not only a capable intellectual, but also a skilled orator, and even today is considered to be among the best speakers that the United States has ever produced. His campaign for presidency was fraught with problems, but at last on November 6, 1860, he was elected the 16th president of the United States. That following December, a number of the secession states in the South who had opposed his nomination declared themselves a separate Confederacy, which was technically illegal. South Carolina led the way and was followed within 2 months by Alabama, Texas, Mississippi, Florida, Louisiana, and Georgia. Not long afterwards, Virginia, Arkansas, Tennessee, and North Carolina joined them. Attempts were made to reconcile, but it was clear that the country was sitting on a volcano. The American Civil War, which was the bloodiest war to ever happen in the United States, started because the free and slave-owning states could not reach an agreement. Abraham Lincoln, a Republican whose platform was to abolish slavery throughout the entire country, had won the presidency, but the country was divided. Understandably, President Lincoln and the states from the Northern Territories refused to recognize the Confederacy and questioned its legitimacy. They feared that this secession would strike a negative blow to democracy and that it would result in the United States splitting into several smaller countries that would constantly be at each other's throats. Through the eyes of an eyewitness, Camp McNeil, Meridian Hill, October the 12th, 1862. I take my pen in hand to inform you that I am well at present and hope that those few lines may find you enjoying the same blessing. I started at soldiering better than 2 months ago. I enlisted in a company called Company F 149 Regiment, PBV. We are now in a camp called McNeil on Meridian Hill near the site of Washington. We are not near all the time in camp. We are the most of the time out to guard hospital, a town, and other places where part of the regiment has moved their tents to town. I expect that our company will move before the week is out, but I do not know for sure. It has been warm and dry ever since we have been down here until last Friday night. About 1 o'clock, it commenced raining and it poured down until about 4. I had to go on guard at 4, so I got sheet of standing in the rain for that night. Since that night, it had felt like husking corn, raining all afternoon. I'm in my tent. My seat is a knapsack. My desk is a portfolio. This is as good a seat as I ever get. Without it, it is a chore. It is said that he that is born of woman and enlisteth in the 149th Regiment, Company F, his days are few and short of rations. He cometh forth tattooed and retired at roll call. Much soldiering hath made him sharp, yea, even so that the set of his breeches is in danger of being cut through. They are all honest. They take nothing that they cannot reach. They capture the most beautiful prize packages of paper and walk off rejoicing. The boys are all brothers and work to each other's honor. They as great set of fellows for fun and have all the furnishings able for what one don't know another do, and so they have some things a good all the time. So the time goes, I can't tell where. If it gets wet, and maybe it won't be quite so nice as it has been since we have been down here. No more at present. I send my respects to all inquiring friends. Tell all that inquire after me that I want them to write to, and I will answer those letters as soon as I can write, and tell me who is there and who has went to war. I want you to write and answer this as soon as you get it, and oblige yours. Isaac Oliver to I.B. Ikeller.
With war on the horizon, it is important to note the key strengths and weaknesses of each side. At first glance, it seemed as if the North had all the muscle. There were over twice as many people living in the North as opposed to the South. The Union also had the advantage of having the Navy, along with a large amount of supplies. Over 90% of the country's boots, shoes, railroad locomotives, firearms, cloth, and pig iron were manufactured up North. But don't let these perks fool you. The Confederate States had a lot going for them, too. For one, they had the best military personnel. 7 of the 8 colleges that were military-based were located in the South. There's no question that they had the better trained officers. Also, the fighting occurred on southern lands. Therefore, the Confederate Army was fighting on the defensive, making it easier to fight the war. They already knew the lands, so they had a distinct advantage. The South could also produce any food that they needed since they were so skilled at farming. They proved themselves to be very resourceful in the manufacturing of firearms by melting down bells from churches, among other things.
The actual Civil War started when the Confederates attacked Fort Sumter in Charleston Bay and forced them to lower the American flag. 4 months after seceding from the Union, there was a scuffle in the harbor. The troops at Fort Sumter needed reinforcements and supplies, but were unable to do so because the South Carolina militia had them surrounded. South Carolina felt like Fort Sumter belonged to them since it was near them and in their territory. The Union believed that Fort Sumter was the property of the United States government, and this is where the conflict began. President Lincoln had his hands tied and did not want to be seen as the aggressor in this situation. Therefore, he told the governor of South Carolina that he was going to send provisions to the fort. He wouldn't send any weapons or troops unless South Carolina decided to attack. Now the burden rested with the Confederates. In April of 1861, the Confederates opened fire on the fort and forced the Union general to surrender. Lincoln did not take too kindly to this act of aggression, so he called out the militia to suppress the insurgents. After this encounter, 4 more slave states seceded from the Union and joined the Confederacy. The stage was set for war. Americans did not expect the war to last long, but boy, were they in for a surprise. In 1861, the first major land-based battle took place. Because the men were enlisted in the Union, that was only a 90-day term, there was a lot of pressure for the troops to start making moves against the Confederate Army. Even though the men weren't properly trained, the idea was that they could win the war quickly and be done with it. Unfortunately for them, this was not the case. On July 21st, the first Battle of Bull Run started. At first, it looked like the Union was going to win. As the day progressed and the heat kicked in, the Union troops got tired and were not ready for the new wave of Confederate soldiers that came to them. The end result was victory for the Confederates, with over 4,800 soldiers from each side wounded, dead, or missing. The next day, Lincoln hired a new general and increased the enlistment of the troops' terms to 3 years. Things got really messy starting in 1862. Huge battles like the one that happened in Shiloh, Tennessee, Gaines Mill, and Fredericksburg, Virginia, resulted in heavy casualties on both sides. In April of 1862, the Confederates attacked General Ulysses S. Grant and his troops while they were cooking breakfast. The attack had been so unexpected that the troops were literally just going at each other with very little direction. By the time night hit, the Union troops had been driven out of their camps and towards the river. The tables turned overnight. General D.C. Buell came and added about 25,000 Union troops to the fight. Although the Union won this battle, it was not without a lot of bloodshed. Considered to be the second major battle in the Civil War, the Battle of Shiloh saw 13,000 Union soldiers killed and 10,700 Confederate soldiers killed. This battle also proved to Americans that this war would not be over quickly. The next major battle was the Second Battle of Bull Run, which saw the war return to the eastern part of the United States. There were more casualties in this battle than in the First Battle of Bull Run, and it was also on a larger scale. The end result was about 24,000 Americans killed, and victory for the Confederates. It also allowed General Lee to advance further north and also paved the way for other battles to occur. The Battle of Antietam was a major turning point in the Civil War. In August of 1862, General Lee marched up north to invade Maryland. The idea was to take some of the pressure away from the Shenandoah Valley, which was considered the breadbasket of the Confederacy. Encouraging Europeans to aid the Confederates by winning a battle in the northern region, and also encourage the slave state of Maryland to secede from the Union and join the Confederacy. Because of the huge defeat at Bull Run, General Lee assumed that the Union would need time to regroup and get themselves together. Therefore, he made the crucial mistake of splitting up his own army. He wrote out his plans on what was called Order No. 191. In a rare turn of events, a copy of Order No. 191 fell into the hands of some Union soldiers. Once the Union found out that the Confederate army was split, Grant took advantage. The battle ended up being the bloodiest in U.S. history, with over 22,000 Americans dead in a single day. Although there is some debate as to who actually won the battle, most agree that the Union had the greatest advantage. On top of stopping the Confederates from invading the North, the war also gave Lincoln the opportunity to make an important announcement, which will be discussed in the next section. Through the eyes of an eyewitness. 4th NC Volunteers, September 30th, 1862, camp near Bunker Hill. Dear father, mother, and sisters, it has been some time since I wrote to you all. I've heard from you 2 or 3 times. I've been in Maryland since I wrote to you, and I've been in 2 very hard battles in Maryland and come out unhurt. I see a great deal and could tell you more than I write if I could see you. A regiment did not have many wounded or killed, but a good many taken prisoner. Frank Shepard and John Fenster, we suppose, are taken. We have not heard from them since the fight. They were not in the fight, were left at the camp. The Yankees took them. On their escape, they took a good many of our Negroes. That was a great victory at Harper's Ferry. I would like to have been in that. Our men did not fire a gun. They burned the Yankees to death, and they gave up everything and raised a white flag and attacked their army. The men say that they saw it, and it was the best thing they ever saw. The 7th Regiment, NC, was there and saw it all. E. Morrison Scroggs was telling me about how they done. He saw it all. I would like to have been there. Our regiment used everything we had. I have no blanket nor any clothes but what I have got. I have got the suit on that you sent me. They came in good time. I like them very well. If I had a good pair of shoes, I would be the best clothed man in the regiment. Pa, I want you to have me a pair of boots made. Those shoes you had made for me ripped all to pieces. Our regiment used everything we had. Cousin Dr. Hill is wounded in the knee very bad. I have nothing more, for my paper is scarce. Write soon to your only son, W. Adams. The Battle of Antietam. By 1864, the Union Army's original goal of a limited battle to restore the United States changed to an all-out war to destroy the Old South and its tradition of slavery. During the onset of the Civil War, both sides seemed to have an equal chance of winning, but after 3 long years, the Confederacy started losing steam. When General Ulysses S. Grant became the commanding general of the entire Union Army, things began to shift in their favor. Lincoln had set up a number of blockades that had effectively cut off the supply lines and support to the South. General Grant's relentless attacks on the South's great General Robert E. Lee proved too much for the latter to handle. By springtime of 1865, the Confederate armies started to surrender one by one. On May 10, 1865, the Union Army cornered and captured the fleeing president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis. With Davis's capture, all the remaining resistance fighters dropped their weapons and surrendered. Finally, after years of war and hundreds of thousands of American soldiers killed, the United States could finally start the painful process of rebuilding the nation. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. When Robert E. Lee's forces eventually managed to cross the Potomac River in 1862, something shifted in the struggle. The eventual victory by the Union over Lee's forces at this battle was one of the bloodiest in the entire war, but it was also a resounding boost in Lincoln's favor. This was the perfect excuse and opportunity for Lincoln to put into play the ace up his sleeve. On July 22, 1862, Abraham Lincoln, dressed in his trademark dark frock coat, convened the members of his cabinet and confided to them that he had dwelt much and long on the subject of owning slaves in the United States of America. Then Lincoln, speaking in measured tones, read the first draft of what would become known as the Emancipation Proclamation, the piece of legislation that effectively made it illegal to own slaves in the United States. He had actually drafted and written the document quite a while before, but for a number of strategic reasons, he had never broached it or put it forward, fearing that to do so while in the middle of a war, and especially in the wake of a possible loss, might constitute a sign of desperation to his supporters. Excerpt from the Emancipation Proclamation. That on the first day of January in the year of our Lord, 1863, all persons held as slaves within any state or designated part of any state, the people whereof shall then be in rebellion against the United States, shall be thenceforward and forever free. and the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authority thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of such persons, and will do no act or acts to repress such persons, or any of them, in any efforts they may make for their actual freedom. On September 22, 1862, Lincoln issued a preliminary proclamation that was essentially a warning to the states that would not end their rebellion. Lincoln said that after 100 days had passed, if they did not cease their secession, he would order the emancipation of all the slaves in their respective states. The Emancipation Proclamation obviously outraged the white Southerners who owned slaves, but it also angered some Northern Democrats, undermined the efforts of European forces to supply aid to the Confederacy, and lifted the spirits of millions of African Americans, both slaves and freemen. The 1862 midterm elections were also, however, underway, and while the Republicans themselves were a bit disgruntled by the way things were going, the Democrats saw it as an opportunity to weaken Lincoln. The Republicans had already managed to infuriate a number of states with high taxes, inflation, and with a martial law that acted to conscript citizens into the Union Army. Nevertheless, with a continual winning streak over the Confederacy, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation became a military goal and would result in almost 3 million slaves being freed. Lincoln even had the dream of developing colonies, especially for freed slaves, although this was never realized. Still, it is important to note that a number of freed slaves eventually joined the ranks of the Union Army. One of Lincoln's generals took it upon himself to create 20 regiments of black soldiers, and they would end up playing a pivotal role in bringing the war to its eventual conclusion. Gettysburg Address. Following another victory in Gettysburg, Lincoln appeared before hundreds of citizens and delivered another enthralling speech that would go down in history as one of the most poignant and self-affirming of American beliefs. It asserted things that he had already talked about and strove to embody, but more than anything, it also offered some hope, as he now envisioned the Civil War as not only being about ending slavery, but also heralding the new birth of freedom in the nation. Transcript of the Gettysburg Address. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they fought here and have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they